Do what?
So did you go back to David's class on Wednesday night?
No, what happened?
So he talked about the culture.
Right.
Where we're headed.
Good man.
He referenced your name many times.
Yeah, he.
Yeah, we've been so depressed and emotional. But then somebody said, at least they're singing in the end. So I'm looking forward to the singing.
That's right. There's a little singing today. There'll be more later. Let's see. Hey, Glenda, would you mind catching that door there? And we're in chapter 13 tonight. Pick up there in our narrative push through Revelation. There is a brief moment of happiness tonight. There is some positive singing, and maybe even we'll learn a little bit about a couple of phrases we've heard before, but never quite really thought about what they mean. Revelation chapter 13, though, we are in the midst of this deeper vision John is given as to what's really going on earth. The dragon is at war with the children of the woman that he can get. This is a means by which, another idiom in the vision, the courts of the temple of God can be trampled. The temple itself cannot be compromised. God's heavenly dwelling place. The saints who are already dead and safe in the arms of Jesus, so to speak. But those on earth, and chapter 12 even ends with that warning, you know, kind of woe to those who are still on the earth, because the dragon knows his time is short and he is full of great wrath, realizing he has been ultimately defeated. So how does the dragon work on earth? Now it's chapter 13, the sea beast and the land beast. The sea beast seems to represent political power, and it does aspire to kind of counterfeit deity, right? A dragon with seven heads, 10 horns, crowns on all seven of those heads. But the dragon doesn't only work by political power. Political power is consolidated in various ways, typically throughout human history. And the book touches on that and understands that. We really don't appreciate how unique the American experiment is in human history, how unique our form of government is with separation of powers. And the reason why our founders designed our country's government system to work the way it does is because they understood the abuses of human history, how the system usually works, and they wanted to put checks and balances on raw human power. And so while our own experience is not quite the same, understand what this depiction is, and understand how much even in our own country, things can revert back to the human normal. And so if the sea beast represents political power, how Satan uses political power, and we all get how often, even in the Bible, government power, political power was used to oppress the people of God. It goes all the way back to Egypt, right? Pharaoh, what did Pharaoh try to do? Kill all the baby boys, right? Didn't want any more of God's people multiplying. All the way down to the days of Nebuchadnezzar, right? Bow down to my image or what? Yeah, you go in the fire. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Nothing new about this. Book of Esther. It was Haman's plot, but what did the king essentially agree to? He didn't care about Jewish people. What did he agree to? Sure, exterminate them, whatever. And so it goes throughout human history, right? The power of the government to oppress and even attempt to exterminate the people of God. One of the other ways, however, short of wholesale slaughter, dramatic persecution, which is actually pretty rare in human history, is to still exert pressure through social means, not just raw political power, throw you in jail or put you to death, but through social means. And the two main pressure points in society for most of human history are religion and economics. Those are the two main pressure points for human society throughout most of human history, right? And so I think about, for instance, John chapter 9. We'll take one example of this. Man born blind. Jesus heals him, right? And the religious leaders are trying to figure out what happened, because rumor is Jesus did it. That's going to make Jesus even more popular. Pretty outstanding miracle. And so they're kind of holding a hearing. It's a committee hearing. They draw his parents in. His parents don't want to vouch for him. He's of age. He can speak for himself. Why are his parents afraid? Remember, what does John's gospel tell us? Yeah, the power of religion in society. If you're not, you know, if you're not part of the synagogue, you know, medieval Europe, you're not part of the Catholic Church, what happens to you? It's not just a matter of going to jail or being put to death. What happens to you? You are not acceptable in society. And that's still the way it works today. I remember years ago when I was traveling in Israel, I was actually spending some time with Roberto Tondelli. Some of you may know Roberto. He's one of the preachers in Italy that we support. And we were having dinner one night, Roberto and a couple others of us. And I made the comment, this was years ago, and I made the comment about how in the United States, the Catholic Church actually helps to provide a buffer for us by its resistance to the abortion and you know, and gay rights and things like that, gay marriage, in ways that kind of make it easier for those of us the government wouldn't care about. You know, the government knows it really can't mess with the Catholic Church too far. And so as long as the Catholics hold the line on that kind of stuff, that actually provides a firewall for us, for Christians in this country. Oh, well, Brother Tondelli was outraged. I would say any good, kind word of, you know, even just acknowledging the usefulness. It was pure utilitarianism, but the usefulness of Catholic power in this country, because he comes from Italy, and guess how it works in Italy? And he read me the riot act, man. My son can't get a job because the priest in town or the bishop in town has told nobody to hire my son who's, you know, been to university and is a very capable computer programmer, and nobody will touch my son because the bishop in town says that kid's bad. We take that for granted in this country, but that's how it is for most of human history. The power of religion, and with it right there, and Brother Tondelli's, you know, kind of reading the riot act because of how it is in a lot of the rest of the world. Not only is his son a social outsider because he's not a good Catholic, but the economic ramifications as well. And that's how it works with the land beast. Read with me. This is one of the other means by which the dragon and the beast can put pressure on people is with the land beast. A second beast rising out of the earth, two horns like a lamb, spoke like a dragon, exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence. And it makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose mortal wound was healed. It performed great signs, making even fire come down from heaven to earth in front of people. And by the signs that it is allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those who dwell on the earth, telling them to make an image for the beast that was wounded by the sword yet lived. And so it teaches people to worship the government, worship the beast. Bottom line is, be part of the world as it is. It makes participation in the world acceptable. It's the false teacher today who, in the name of Christianity, rationalizes gay marriage, finds ways to sit there and say you can have it both ways. That's what the land beast does. It makes the worship of the devil, so to speak, respectable and rationalizable. And it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast, so the image of the beast might speak, and it might cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain. Remember that story, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Nothing new about this. And it also causes all. Now, here's the key, verse 16. Notice, it's an equal opportunity demander of allegiance. It also causes all, small and great, rich and poor, slave and free, to be marked on their right hand or their forehead so that no one can buy or sell. In other words, not everybody who refuses to participate is put to death. What's in some ways a just as equally severe consequence? Unless he has the mark of the beast on his right hand or his forehead, he cannot buy or sell. And what is the mark? The mark is the name of the beast or the number of its name. This calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. And yes, there have been all sorts of attempts throughout human history to unravel the mystery. Everybody understands the concept of gematria. That's the fancy name for using letters as numbers. Truth of the matter is, very few writing systems had their own separate number system like we do, where we have letters and we have numbers. The letters were your numbers. They did it in Hebrew. They did it in Greek. They did it in Roman, or Latin, rather. Remember learning your Roman numerals when you were a kid growing up, right? And so most writing systems use the letters as numbers. And so the idea was, you know, everybody's name kind of added up to something, so to speak. And it may well be some have tried to make this work as Nero's name, and that's a possible historical referent. But remember, we're kind of working on a larger principle, ideals? What are the big ideas in this? And even if we can adduce the numbering of the name to some particular historical personage, like a Nero. The larger symbolism, I think, is still just as obvious as well, which is this, 666. It's the unholy trinity. If God's number is seven, instead of three sevens, you get three sixes. What day was man created on? Sixth day. And ultimately, we've already seen in everything from the dragon wearing crowns to the beast wearing crowns to the land beast wearing crowns. What's all of this about? Aspiring to be God. And so it's the unholy trinity. It's the man to be God, and even the human participation in that. Everybody wants to be God, and nobody wants to let God be God, whether it's Satan wearing the crown, whether it's kings who claim to be gods, or whether it's the average human being who simply refuses to bow the knee to God and thus, in some sense, thinks they're their own creator. It's the number of a man in the most basic sense as well. Marked on the right hand or the forehead. Couple things about that. Number one, just like so many other things in this chapter, counterfeits, right? The image of God, and God breathes into his own image, man, life, and man instead creates unworthy counterfeits. The beasts are really kind of humans acting in concert. What is political power? What is the sea beast? But humans working in their own arrogance. You know, it's no particular demon that's doing what the land beast does. It's people, false teachers and priests, bureaucrats who enforce economic policies that ostracize those who refuse to participate as right-thinking people should in the culture. And so here the counterfeit marked on the forehead and the right hand. Remember in Deuteronomy, where were you supposed to put your phylacteries? Forehead and right hand. This is again the counterfeit. This is the counterfeit. Whereas the true follower of God should keep God's word, you know, and literally, you know, in front of his eyes and on his right hand. In other words, all that you do and what you think and how you act, your right hand is the symbol of your own agency and power. Is meant to be, you know, controlled by God's word and God's values. Instead, under the teaching of the land beast, you found ways to rationalize participating in the world. And that's what really guides your thinking and your action. And so you are marked on the right hand and on the forehead with the mark of the beast. Everybody gets a mark, though, in the Bible, don't they? We already saw earlier in the book, right? God marked his people. Everybody gets a mark in Revelation. Everybody wears a mark. And we'll come back to that in a sec. The one other thing I want you to notice, though, about this is notice the grounds, the better way to put it is the consequences for not being marked by the beast, for not being, you know, identified by the world as a right-thinking person, as an ally. What's the consequence? It's not just to be slain, because they didn't kill everybody, and the book never claims that everybody's going to die for the sake of truth. What's the consequence? Can't buy or sell. In other words, can't have a job, can't go to college, can't learn a trade, can't be part of the guild, can't get a professional license. Why are these people, why are those who refuse to get the mark of the beast cut out? Because they would not affirm, because they would not worship. So that no one can buy or sell unless they have this mark. Most of the U.S.'s history, we've dealt with a policy of tolerance. You know, the government remains neutral, and we have equal employment laws and things like that. We've not had perfect justice in our culture, but what's changing, and I think some of you have maybe noticed this, especially the past 4 or 5 years in your workplace, perhaps. Certainly, the younger generation is more and more demanding affirmation. That's what Pride Month's about more and more. Now it's not just about letting them have their parades and their cakes and, you know, and their parties. What's expected more and more? That you must, well, not just accept. Accept is a form of tolerance. Just you know, to accept means I can ignore it. I won't tell them they're wrong. I'll just ignore it. But that's not acceptable anymore in and of itself. What's more and more the pressure? You have to engage in it. I remember years ago now, this was kind of canary in the coal mine moment. A friend of mine I went to college with works for the Department of Agriculture. He's a research scientist, got a PhD from Auburn in poultry science. Your tax dollars at work, I don't know. But he researches chickens for the government, for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, some lab up in Pennsylvania somewhere. Last I had contact with him, this was back during the Obama administration, actually, so a couple of election cycles ago. And this was also before gay marriage was the law of the land per the Supreme Court, I might add. But it was the Obama administration, and the Obama administration was very progressive about these things. Now, keep in mind, he's a research scientist. He doesn't interact with the public. He doesn't, you know, and what he, you know, chickens don't know whether they're gay or not. They don't have an identity. They just produce eggs. That's what they do. And so, you know, what he does as a research scientist on poultry for the government has nothing to do with gay rights or whether they should or should or whatever. And I remember getting an email from him one year. June, it was you know, late spring. It was like May, June was rolling around. He was just kind of wrestling with his conscience because he said, I got a memo from my department. We're going to be having a bunch of pride events this month, and there's really kind of this pressure to go to some of these. And yeah, maybe, you know, and it's, you know, all through the month, not just one thing where I can, you know, conveniently schedule a meeting or be out of town, you know, the conference that week or whatever. All through the month, maybe finding legitimate excuses for why I can't make a couple of these events, but dodging all of them, you know, I'm going to be noticed. It's one of those Daniel 3 moments where everybody's called to the idol, including Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Remember, everybody is called to the idol in that story. And Nebuchadnezzar says, when the music plays, what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to bow. There's no hiding in the office. Everybody's called to the meeting. And so he was just wrestling with, what do you do? Do the right thing is what I told him. I have another friend, another part of the country, very high up executive, division CEO of a major, major corporation. And I remember him telling the story. This was several years ago now. He's retired. I remember him telling the story. He said, we had a, you know, all division CEO meeting with the big CEO of kind of our whole deal. And our top CEO was very progressive, he said, very, very liberal about this stuff. And so we're at this meeting, and there's a bunch of us, and he's just walking the room doing what he does, talking about, gay rights and all this kind of stuff, and talking in a way that no right-thinking person would have a problem with this. You know, and almost talking like if I knew anybody in this room had a problem with this, you know, we'd probably have to get rid of him. And my friend tells a story of, I said, I remember sitting that meeting that day wondering, is this the day my career ends and I lose my job? Because if you ask the question, if you ask for a show of hands and whatnot, and the God blesses me, he said, I was committed to doing the right thing. But he said, it went through my mind, is this the day, you know, here I am in my 50s, late career, climbed the ladder, is this the day I end my career and I lose my job? What happens if he does? What happens if he goes to the next step instead of just mocking and decides that, you know, by the way, none of you actually believe that, do you? What are you going to do? And that's the world we are more and more going into. That's the world our children are going to inherit, those of us who are raising kids, is a world in which it's not enough just to keep your mouth shut and your head down, but to affirm, to be a part of it. And if you don't affirm, you don't get to buy and sell. Is there a day coming in which a Christian can't be a lawyer? Yeah, it may well happen. It's certainly happening in Canada, by the way, if you're paying attention to what goes on in Canada. Canada cracked down on law schools at Christian universities because they refused to bow the knee about gay rights in Canada. Canada doesn't have a Bill of Rights, and so it can be even more draconian legally. But understand this, laws in the First Amendment won't protect you because the First Amendment only means what the Supreme Court says it means, not what you think it means in terms of how it's going to work out. And I remember when Obergefell, the gay marriage decision, was being argued, I remember Justice Alito asking Solicitor Vercelli of the government, isn't this going to cause, if we rule in favor of gay marriage in this, basically, isn't this going to cause a potential conflict between religious liberty and gay rights? And the Solicitor General of the United States said, yeah, it will. And that's not been all worked out yet legally because there haven't been enough lawsuits about it yet. But it was acknowledged that there is going to be pressure on it. And then at the end of the day, no matter what you think it should mean, literally how our laws are going to play out depends upon the interpretation of the Supreme Court. Don't think you're going to hide behind laws ultimately on this, especially long term, when more and more justices are being trained by elite law schools that do not. I've heard stories from people I know, kind of friends of friends of friends kind of thing, in elite law schools where from the professors on down, religion makes no sense to these people anymore. They can't even begin to understand why anybody would think this way, order their life around these principles, these values, this kind of a book. And so, you know, those elite law schools are where the federal judges come from, and eventually the Supreme Court justices come from. This next generation cannot comprehend why anybody would have a problem with these things. This is how it works. We go back to the baseline of what's normal for human history. Sorry for the darkness. Move on. Say again. And well, yeah, sure. But in the meantime, they have the power. Absolutely. And so, pretend number 14 doesn't exist there, because the scene continues on. As he looks and sees those, on the one hand being marked, you know, bearing the mark of the beast, he also sees and looks, and behold, on Mount Zion stood the Lamb, and with him 144,000. That's a symbolic number, right? That's all of God's people. Who had his name and his father's name written where? On their forehead. See, everybody gets a mark in the book. Everybody wears a mark. You better wear the right mark when the time comes. That's part of the story. And I heard a voice from heaven like the roar of many waters, like the sound of thunder. The voice I heard was like the sound of harpists playing on their harps. And they were singing a new song before the throne. See, there is singing eventually. In the midst of all that darkness for those on, for the saints on earth, for those who are already with the Lamb, what are they doing? They're singing. I lost my place. And no one could learn the song except the 144,000 who had been redeemed from the earth. Why could only the 144,000 know the song? Real simple. Because only those people, once they're in heaven, understand the full value of salvation. See, right now when you suffer in this life, is there a temptation to give up? Have you experienced the full value of what it means to be saved yet? No, that's why it's hard right now. But for those who get to Mount Zion in the end, 144,000, what can they sing with full knowledge and appreciation of? Salvation. The Lamb. They know firsthand it was worth it. They're experiencing it. The reason they alone can know is what Psalm 107 talks about in another Old Testament context. Just to read a couple of verses from the beginning of that psalm to help us understand. Psalm 107, "Oh, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever." He's loyal even in the worst of possible earthly situations. Notice the next line, though. "Let the redeemed of the Lord say so, whom he has redeemed from trouble and gathered in from the lands, from east and west, north and south." It's those who have actually experienced that final end gathering who can sing the song, because they know. You and I are learning that song by our faithfulness in this life. That's how you learn the song. That makes sense? You want to be able to sing the song in the last day? You have to learn how to sing the song by being faithful in this life. Yes, ma'am, Jana.
Can you remind me what the 144,000
is? Yeah, all of God's people of all times, of all places. Because what it is it's 12 times 12 times 1,000, right? So 12 and 12, we've seen different ways of that number being worked out thus far in the book, like the 24 elders. Sometimes they're added, sometimes it's multiplied. In this case, it's multiplied. So 12 times 12 is 144, Old Covenant, New Covenant, all of God's people. And then 1,000 is just the extreme form of completeness, utter completeness. It's 10 times 10 times 10. So fully complete. Pat Robertson stole it. he's the one who does the 700. Who does the 700 Club? Was it Pat Robertson? Okay. Yeah. Well. Anyways. All right. Well, does that make sense? That's where this song comes from. And so you want to know the song? There's only one way to learn it, and it's a pretty exclusive club. Be faithful unto death. That's how you learn how to sing the song. It is these who have not defiled themselves with women, for they are virgins. Now that right there tells you that this is a spiritual, they have not defiled themselves with women, because not every Christian is literally a virgin. Most people in this room are married. In what sense are they virgins? In what sense have they not defiled themselves with women? In the Bible, Old Testament, idea of the people of God as God's bride, And so going all the way back to like Hosea and Gomer as an image of spiritual infidelity. They have not compromised themselves with the world. We'll see here in a few more pages, chapter 17, chapter 18, the power of the, you know, it was Rome back then, it's the United States today, just let's be honest, depicted as the dominant power of each era, depicted as an adulterous woman sitting on seven hills. The harlot, you may have heard of the great whore of Babylon idea. Yeah. And that's the whole point, is God's people committing spiritual harlotry for the sake of peace, security, or just comfort and pleasure in this world. That's right, yeah. And people could literally do that in the name of false religion, but even more so spiritually. Because here's the thing. Here's the thing. Most people who commit adultery, most people who defile themselves with women, so to speak, how often is it that they completely abandon their marriage, or is it just something they do on the side without their spouse's knowledge? It's often the duplicity that's involved in the adultery, right? I go home to my lawful husband or wife while I cheat with this other person. And that's when, you know, I mean, you know, think about how many times over the years, unfortunately, scandal in the church, somebody was cheating on their spouse didn't know. It's the spiritual version of that. People who think they can have the world and still go home to God at night. Compromise with the culture. No, we don't want to suffer. We don't want to be put out of the synagogue. We don't want to not be able to buy and sell. We don't want our children to miss out on opportunities. Think about all the lines of rationalization we use. And it's spiritual adultery. We find ways to sleep with the world, so to speak, and still have God as well. And God knows. And those who get to sing the song in the end are virgins. They have not defiled themselves with the world. These have been redeemed from mankind as first fruits for God and the Lamb. And look at what its last line now in their description. And in their mouth no lie was found, for they are blameless. In their mouth no lie was found. Now, this is not just all liars go in the lake of fire kind of stuff. In this context of this book, it's a particular lie that's in mind. It's not just, you know, you shouldn't tell lies. You know, you shouldn't fudge on your taxes, and you shouldn't lie to your spouse about where you were when you got home late from work, et cetera, et cetera. There is no lie singular found in their mouth. What's the lie? Well, yeah, but what would be the lie? That these type of people, just like they're not sleeping with the world, so to speak, what's the lie that somebody might be tempted to tell?
They're part of the world when they are supposed to be God.
That's right. Are you a Christian? And you say in a moment of weakness, no. Even though you're not going to live like the world, even though you feel bad about it later, your refusal to confess him when the chips are down, because the world wants you to affirm them instead. And to do anything less than to fully and unapologetically say Jesus is Lord is to tell a lie. We forget that sometimes because Jesus is Lord. And so in any way to give any affirmation to the world, and this is where it gets kind of scary for all of us, kind of fear and trembling moment. Any affirmation of the world's lies for the sake of comfort, pleasure, self-protection is to tell a lie. It's to participate in the world's lie. I mean, Earl used the language a second ago about, you know, they're deceived. Yes, they are. They're living by lies. Lies they tell themselves but have become, and have lied to themselves so much they're absolutely convinced they're true, but they're lies nonetheless. And when you or I, to protect ourselves or save ourselves, affirm that which we know is not true, get the world off our back, what have we done? What have we told? We've told a lie. And those who get to sing the song are not liars. Not just because they don't fudge on their taxes, but because when the chips are down, they tell the truth. And so what does, you know, compare, we often compare Peter and Judas when Jesus, you know, the night Jesus is betrayed. Even more stunning, though, is to compare Jesus and Peter, because both of them are on trial, so to speak. And when Jesus, or when Peter is asked, are you one of them, what does Peter say? No. When Jesus is asked, are you he, what does Jesus say?
Yes, as you say.
It's as you say. I'm the one you seek. you know, all through the eating, whether it's in the garden, again, different accounts, you know, he says it different times in different ways in different accounts. But all the way through the night, whenever he's asked, who are you? Yeah, even, you know, when Pilate. He tells the truth all the way through. If they kill him for it, so be it. But Peter would not tell the truth that night. It's a war out there, folks. That's what Revelation is trying to get us to understand. We Christians have been coddled too long, and we don't want to know the truth about our situation. And that's what part of Revelation is meant to reveal. This is the reality of our situation. And the question all of us have to ask ourselves is, have we already become more compromised than we realize? Have we already told more lies than we realize to keep the world off our backs? Yes, ma'am.
I'm asking you if I lied.
Uh-oh. That's when you and God, Glenda, I don't know.
My dad died and I was writing his obituary.
Yeah.
And my brother is trying to pass as a woman.
Oh, yeah. Right.
And I said, no, I can't say that.
Yeah.
But I did say he had four children.
I think there's a place for tact. Jesus certainly used tact in his, even kind of the, what you said a second ago, Brother Dunsmore, about, you know, it is as you say, because he also knew they were playing games with him, you know. I think there's a place for tact and wisdom and judgment. Jesus and the prophets certainly use that. I think you certainly can't say he had your dad had four daughters, like you avoided. I think, you know, linguistic pressure will get under more and more, and I think every one of us kind of has to just kind of find our backbones. You know, you familiar with this pronoun business everybody's big on now? You know, some places I've heard of, you know, name tags and people put their pronouns, and you're expected to do what? Speak to people by their pronouns. And the problem is, you know, if you tell them, you know, if you call a man by she, what are you doing?
You might not know.
Well, okay, I think God, yeah, I know. That's the scary thing, Jenna, is some people, we're getting to the point where, yes, I know. Yeah, every once in a while, me and the kids will be out somewhere. Is that a man or a woman? I can't be sure. You remember the old Saturday Night Live skit? It's Pat. The sad thing is, you know, now truth is stranger than fiction. We all live in a bad comedy sketch now. But when it's obvious, and sometimes it's obvious because, you know, a grievously overweight man with a wig wants to be claim to be a woman, like this assistant's, you know, undersecretary in HHS. This, you know, Rachel Levine is her official name. Her true name is Richard Levine. It's a man parading as a woman. You know, ironically, and head of certain aspects of healthcare in this country, don't get me started. A doctor who thinks he's a woman, but you and I, you know, but he has more authority over. I think to call that man by female pronouns, knowing, and, you know, it's very obviously a man in a dress, yeah, it's to tell a lie. Words mean something. Words mean something. And is that going to get us in trouble more and more? Yeah. In Canada, in certain contexts, it's a crime. Not to call people by their preferred, but they don't have a First Amendment. There's not speech protections. And so in certain contexts, to refuse to call somebody by their preferred pronouns is a prosecutable offense. This is the world we're headed into. But do you tell the truth or not? Do you tell the truth or not? And I think this is something we have to be telling our kids. Lower your expectations for life. And get out of this world as one of the 144,000. Don't worry about the fact you don't get to go to med school or law school or be CEO or, you know, we have too often, you know, been more concerned about our kids following their dreams in this life than making it to heaven as their true goal. The image we need to give our kids is not, you know, work hard in high school, get a scholarship and go to a good college. It's be part of the 144,000. Be marked and known to God. Because here's what happens in the end. You see this happier scene for those who refuse to join in the lying on earth. And I saw another angel flying directly overhead with an eternal gospel to proclaim to those who dwell on earth, to every nation, tribe, language, and people. And he said with a loud voice, "Fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him who made heaven and earth, sea and springs of water." Get it right, you earth dwellers. Know who made you and know who you should be worshiping. And another angel followed, a second one, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great." In the Bible, Babylon is not just literal Babylon. Babylon is a metaphor for any great power, from Egypt and Exodus to Rome at the end of the first century era to the United States today to whatever comes after us if the world lets time, or if the Lord lets time go on. It's always Babylon in the Bible as the great oppressor of God's people. But at the end of the story, Babylon falls. She who made all the nations drink the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality. See, that's what it means to be a virgin in the Bible. You didn't sleep with Babylon when everybody else did. And another angel, a third, followed them, saying with a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast in its image and receives a mark on his forehead or on his hand, he also will drink the wine of God's wrath, poured full strength into the cup of his anger, and he will be tormented with fire and sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever, and they have no rest day or night, these worshipers of the beast and its image, whoever receives the mark of its name. And on the basis of that warning, here's the application to us, because this book was ultimately given to Christians. Here is a call for the endurance of the saints, those who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. With that firm warning in our minds, what should you and I do? What's the big word in that verse?
Persevere
or endure. Pay the price in this life so that you can sing the song on Zion in the end. The Bible calls us not to comfort. The Bible calls us to endurance, folks. Teach that to your kids and grandkids. I'm serious. That's what the Bible calls us to. And I heard a voice from heaven saying, write this. Blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Blessed indeed, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds followed them. And I looked, and behold, and now he sees a scene of judgment, a white cloud, and seated on the cloud, one like a son of man with a golden crown on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. Who is this?
Jesus.
Yeah, it's Jesus. Remember, what does Jesus say at one of his trials? Before the Jewish leaders, because Pilate wouldn't get this. He didn't know the Old Testament, but the Jewish leaders did. And they're harassing him. Who are you? Who are you? Are you the Christ? Are you? I remember what he finally says that become the words on the earth that are on the basis of the which they claim he blasphemed. And you will see the Son of Man where? Yeah, sitting at the right hand, coming in the clouds. And what does Revelation now show us? The coming of that day. And I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and seated on the cloud, one like a son of man, golden crown on his head, sharp sickle in his hand. And another angel came out of the temple, calling with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud, put in your sickle and reap, for the hour to reap has come. What did Jesus say when he was asked, when would the end come? No one knows but who? The Father. And so what you see here is the moment when from the temple, from the Father, the word comes to the Son as he sits on his own throne. Now is the time. Put in your sickle and reap, for the hour to reap has come, for the harvest of the earth is fully ripe. And so he who sat on the cloud swung his sickle across the earth, and the earth was reaped. It will be no challenge for Jesus in the end, when the end comes. And another angel came out of the temple in heaven, and he too had a sharp sickle. And another angel came out from the altar, the angel who had authority over the fire, and he called with a loud voice to the one who had the sharp sickle, put in your sickle and gather the clusters from the vine of the earth, for its grapes are ripe. And so the angel swung his sickle across the earth, gathered the grape harvest of the earth, threw it in the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden outside the city, and blood flowed from the winepress as high as a horse's bridle for 1,600 stadia, or for hundreds of miles, basically. It was an orgy of blood when the winepress of God's wrath, where the grapes of wrath are stored, Battle Hymn of the Republic, yeah. Is where that image comes from. But notice verse 18. Where did the angel come who calls out to do this? Where did the angel come from?
From the altar.
From the altar. Isn't that interesting? From the altar. Go with me back to chapter 14 and verse 18. I'm sorry. Look with me ahead to chapter 16. End of verse 6, getting a little bit ahead of myself, but for sake of time, notice what happens here. As the world is judged, one of the angels says, verse 5, just are you, O Holy One, and who is and who was, for you brought these judgments, for they have shed the blood of the saints and the prophets, and you have given them blood to drink. It is what they deserve. And I heard the altar saying, yes, Lord God, the Almighty, true and just are your judgments. Twice here, as the book begins to wrap up with final judgment, with images of final judgment, the altar is referenced. What altar are we talking about? Chapter 6, beginning of the book. Remember, we identified it as the question that drives the book. The fifth seal, souls under the altar of those who had been slain. And what was their question? How long? And Revelation, by the way, still refuses to answer. How long? You know, when does the angel tell Jesus on his throne to stick out his sickle? Well, the Bible still doesn't tell us when. Doesn't answer the question of how long. But what does the Bible very clearly once again affirm is going to happen? It will happen. And when it happens, do those who have suffered in this life believe they've been given justice by God? That's what you're seeing here. That's what the angel from the altar and then the voice from under the altar, the souls themselves proclaim is what? Justice has been done. There will be singing in the end. There will be singing in the end. It gets dark. It may get darker first. But there are going to be songs in the end. And the souls under the altar finally get to see vengeance. God will deal with the dragon. He will deal with the land and the sea beast. He will deal with the people by which the land and the sea beast act. I mean, at the end of the day, there is no literal beast. What is the land beast? It's government. It's people. You know, what are these beasts? You know, what is economic people, you know, and officials who, you know, bureaucrats, they're people who say you can't do this, you can't be here. Business leaders who say you can't do this, you can't be here. You know, they are the beast. But the sickle will fall. And there will be blood and there will be judgment. And the king is on his throne and the hour is coming. And here's the thing that makes us uncomfortable. Again, I'm jumping ahead a little bit for sake of time. But chapter 16, again, notice what's said when that moment comes. Just are you, O Holy One, I'm in verse 5, chapter 16, who is and who was, for you brought these judgments. For they have shed the blood of the saints and the prophets. You have given them blood to drink. It is what they... make you uncomfortable? I mean, aren't we used to turning the other cheek and not wanting anybody to go to hell? And yet, what's the language here at the end? Mercy and justice have to have each other. There is no mercy if there is no justice. And pure justice with no mercy, in one sense, I think what the Bible's trying to tell us is, would not be justice. But who alone knows how to split the difference between those two? Yeah, human courts to try... at our best, we try, but we fail. We fail to give perfect justice, showing mercy at the right times and fierce and unyielding judgment at others. Who alone can split the difference is God. Don't be more righteous than God. There is a sense in which those who are going to be lost deserve what they get. Especially those who have hurt the people of God and thus even further rebelled against God's purposes in human history. And there is a time and place, because to be more righteous than God is to fail to give God the full praise he is due for the justice he has wielded. Don't be more righteous than God. Just like, by the way, just like the world struggles, you know, I just couldn't believe God who would send people to hell. That's not my God. We struggle, or rather the world struggles with certain aspects of God's justice and therefore rationalizes it away. We do the same on the other side sometimes. Let God's justice in both directions be what it's supposed to be. Sometimes we want more mercy than what God's prepared to offer, just like the world doesn't want justice towards, you know, homosexuals or certain favored behaviors. Makes sense? We sometimes fall in the opposite trap of, it's not good to want people to get judgment. In the Bible, there's a time and place in which judgment is good. And it is for something that God is to be praised for. They got what they deserve. That's literally the language of the Bible. Don't be more righteous than God. All right, let me stop. Comments or questions? A lot kind of thrown out there tonight. Does that make sense? Does the image of the world and how it works that's being painted here, does that make sense? Does that connect? Do we get the seriousness? This is something that, I didn't get this kind of stuff, growing up in church when I was a kid. You know, that there is a war, and it is far more easy to be compromised than we realize. And by the way, I mean, that was the irony of, most of you are familiar with, kind of the two great dystopias of 20th century literature. One was George Orwell's 1984, Big Brother is Watching You. And the other was a lesser known one, Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. How many of you, most of you have heard of 1984, how many of you have heard of Huxley's Brave New World or read it? So here's the thing that was interesting. Both of them painted the world. By the way, they knew about each other. They wrote each other. It's a really small world. Huxley taught Orwell. Huxley was older than Orwell. Orwell had Huxley as a teacher at the private school he attended back when he was a young man. They knew of each other's books, and they wrote to each other about them. Ultimately, Huxley, you know, the older man at that point writing to Orwell, said, "I think my book's still more right." Orwell writes right after World War II with the rise of communism. He fears totalitarianism. He has seen what the Soviets are capable of. He fears that that is the world's future. Huxley, however, was not worried about us being controlled by fear. He figured we'd be more easily controlled by our pleasures. Because if you know the story, the world of Brave New World, the way they dealt with people was not by putting them to death. The way they dealt with people was by kicking them out of society and the pleasures of society, where everybody gets drugs, sex, and a TV screen, basically. Sounds familiar? Your glowing screen, your unlimited supply of drugs, and it sounds like this younger generation of people in mom's basement is what it sounds like, frankly. But the irony was, and I think ultimately Huxley was right, that we are far more easily manipulated by taking away our pleasures than by fear. The Soviets learned that because the Soviets are gone. You can only control so many people so long by means of fear. But you can control people a long time by taking away their pleasures. And we are living in a world in which that's more and more possible. You familiar with the Chinese social credit system, how China works? Social credit, you know where your credit score is, right? What's your credit score? You want to buy or sell, you got to have good enough credit. And you do that by handling your money properly. You know, don't go into too much debt, pay back your credit cards, pay back your previous loans, your credit score goes up, and you get more and better loans on more and favorable terms as you go through life and get a better credit score. Social credit works very much like what was being depicted here, and this is how Chinese society works now, which is basically if you do what they want you to do, your social credit score goes up. Your social credit score is what you need to be able to travel. You know, because remember, in a highly automated world, you go to buy your plane ticket or your train ticket online, they know who you are. I mean, our government does that, right? You've already been vetted on whether you're on a do not fly list when you buy your plane ticket from southwest.com. Your social credit score isn't good enough, you don't get that plane ticket in China. You don't get your train pass or your train ticket. You aren't allowed to get certain jobs because your employer checks your social credit score to see if you're a right-thinking person. How do you improve your social credit score in China? By doing things the government wants. How do you lose your social credit score? By doing things they don't like being a religious person. It dings your social credit score. Being a friend of somebody that the state government doesn't like on social media dings your social credit score. Let's say Robin gets in trouble with the government, and the Chinese government sees that Robin and I are friends on social media. That's going to hurt my social credit score too, unless I defriend her. See how this works? It's a way of isolating and cutting people off. It's called the social credit system. Completely driven. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yes, Robin knows what she did. but you see how this works and how it becomes a means of control. And they don't throw, you know, they can't throw everybody in the gulags. So what do they do instead? Your ability to fully participate in society. You want your kid to get into a good college? Better not mess up your social credit score, because we're looking at your social credit score when your kid applies to MIT. See how this works? And so we can't throw, you know, all 1 billion of them in the gulags. How do we control people? By removing their ability to fully participate in society. The Chinese have already mastered this. There are surveillance cameras everywhere. They know where you go. I mean, by the way, just like Facebook, you know, you check in places or they're always tracking. They know already where you go and what you do. Imagine that turned to nefarious purposes. They know you went to church this morning. Ding on your social credit score. Because you're tracked by your cell phone. China already does this. The technology to exist does this if somebody more sinister in the West wants to do this.
Well, it's coming.
I wonder sometimes, Bev, because the younger generation wants affirmation of the right things. And so I think that, it, again, I think it will get dicier for our kids and grandkids. It's called endurance, folks. It's called endurance. This is how you learn to sing the song on Mount Zion. There will be singing, but the way you learn it is not to go to sing in school or our Wednesday night song practices in the summer. It's to live life well so that you actually know the song, the verses to the song when the time comes. You understand what it means to be redeemed. You understand what he's delivered you from. You can sing with full conviction the lyrics of the song of Moses and the Lamb when the time comes. Well, still getting as far as I wanted tonight. Next week, we really will try to plow. Do want to get to chapter 17 and 18, look at the great whore of Babylon. Chapter 17 is especially poignant because it describes what a dying society looks like. It describes what a dying society looks like. Yeah, and it's hard not to read some of those verses and just say, supply chain crisis, anybody? Because sometimes this is what it looks like in real life, too, where inflation goes up and the boats sit offshore and our systems are breaking down. Doesn't mean it's the end, by the way, because it was literally fulfilled against Rome and the world's still here. This is just how God brings empires to their knees. Those who think, I alone live and there will never be any other. And God sits in the heavens and laughs. Which is why it's not worth fornicating with the beast in the meantime. Because the beast always dies in the end. Babylon always falls in the end. That's why you don't want to lose your spiritual virginity by speaking a lie right now and miss out on something far greater that's coming down the road. So, yes, ma'am. Last word, Glenda, for tonight. Yeah, I mean, maybe it's because we don't suffer anymore. You know, we sometimes sit there and think, you know, when Paul and Barnabas are singing at midnight in the Philippian jail, you know, oh, you know, what great faith, whatever. You ever think maybe the whole reason they can sing is because they suffer? Something to think about. See you next week.